Thank you for listening to the Impact Leaders Podcast, featuring leaders focusing on sustainable and impact investment and performance with purpose, sharing their stories, experiences, and advice to increase awareness in the market and highlight best practices in order to help more companies and institutions transition more capital into the industry faster. I'm JP Dalman, founder and CEO of ILM Partners. I am grateful that you're choosing to invest your time in doing this, since I know that you're going to feel encouraged and inspired. Make sure you subscribe to get the notifications from your preferred podcast platform. And do follow us on social media to stay connected. We appreciate your support. It helps keep Impact Leaders going. Enjoy this episode. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Impact Leaders. I hope everyone is safe and healthy and doing the most you can in the current situation. In today's episode of Impact Leaders, we have Mark Campanale as our guest. Hi, Mark.
Hi, JP. Thanks for having me on your program.
No, welcome, and thank you for being with us today. I'm going to say again and again, but it's a real honor. So as an introduction, I think I must share with the audience your extensive bio, kind of a shortened version, since I think it's appropriate and relevant for context and for those that are meeting you for the first time. So Mark is the founder of Carbon Tracker Initiative and conceived the Unburnable Carbon Capital Markets thesis. He commissioned and was editor of Unburnable Carbon, Are the World Financial Markets Carrying a Carbon Bubble? A report that launched in November 2011. More recently, Mark founded the Fish Tracker Initiative, which focuses on limits to growth in the fishes space, which is now part of Planet Tracker, where he is a founding director. He is responsible for management strategy, all matters, and developing their capital markets framework analysis. And their goal is to align capital markets with natural ecological limits to growth. Now, prior to forming those groups, Mark had 25 years experience in sustainable financial markets, working for major financial asset management companies. He was co-founder of some of the first responsible investment funds, firstly at Jupiter Asset Management in 1999 with Ecology Funds, MPI with Global Care, the AMP Capital Sustainable Future Funds, and Henderson Global Investors Industries of Future Funds. Mark served on the World Business Council for Sustainable Development Working Group on Capital Markets, leading up to the 1992 Earth Summit, was a member of the steering committee at UNEP Financial Sector Initiative from 1999 to 2003, and continues to advise a number of financial institutions, including Tribe Impact Capital and Consilium Capital. Mark is the founding director of the UK Sustainable and Responsible Investment Forum, UKSIF, from 1990 to 2006. He's a member of the Advisory Council of ImpactBase.org, a member of the Advisory Board of the Gordon and Betty Moore Foundation's Conservation and Markets Initiative, a member of the UNCTAD's Sustainable Stock Exchange Green Finance Advisory Group, and is the Honorable Treasurer of the Rainforest Foundation UK. Mark was also founder of the Social Stock Exchange, funded by the Rockefeller Foundation, and more recently, the Society Capital. And if that all wasn't enough, he has a BA in Politics and Economic History and Master in Science in Agricultural Economics. What a life and great contribution to our society, Mark. That's, again, it's a real honor to have you with us. It's such a lot of work that you have done.
Oh, thank you.
Anything I should add? I always ask that question just in case.
Well, you know, everything I do, I really enjoy doing, which is a fortunate position to be in. And it's a trend of everything that I do is related. And it's all about looking at the world through the challenges the world faces, social or environmental challenges, through the lens of financial markets, which is something which I've always been interested in and helps me interpret some of these challenges in a slightly different way to how others might do. But I'm not an academic. I don't like to read books. I like to understand issues and challenges and then find novel ways of working together with other people to go about dealing with these challenges.
Yes, yes. And I've noticed, you know, through all the work you're doing, how you are exactly doing that, you know, challenging from a very commercial perspective, I would say, as well. which is, you know, the I guess that's the link that you say, the finance side.
It has to be applied, applicable. Yeah. The ideas, I mean, it's good to study, but you've got to be able to translate it into real-world changes and real-world actions. And I also like business. I've always had an interest in business, but social business, business that creates value for beyond purely financial value, but has something for other people and for the planet, really.
Yes, not just for this one.
Does this make me an old hippie, JP? I think it probably does.
I don't think so, you know, but let's continue. So the first question we tend to ask our guests is the question of, you know, what is sustainable and impact investing? In this case, Mark, you know, coming from both angles, I guess, what is your personal definition of you?
Yeah, let's look at the impact first. The key thing for me really is the question of intentionality. Is the business and the people behind it, are they deliberately or intentionally trying to create a positive social or environmental impact? And then if so, how do they describe it? And it has to be reflected in the way that they're organized. So there's lots of businesses which are helping make the world a better place, but they do it as a byproduct. They're not really saying this is how we want to address the challenge. And there's a lot of so-called good businesses which are domiciled in tax havens or don't pay people a living wage. The other thing about sustainability, let's turn to that definition. I think of it in terms of recognizing ecological boundaries, the limits to the planet, the ability of soils and the species to regenerate in a sustainable way, rather than us exhausting water or the atmosphere. And that, to me, is what sustainability is about. But it also has a social dimension as well as an environmental one. It's about allowing communities and people to work together successfully in a way that thrives and doesn't divide people. So it has a social dimension as well.
Yes, I like that. Because, you know, I think a few people that have been on the podcast have definitely mentioned the intentionality part, but I like how you put the kind of ecological boundaries. I haven't heard it that way before. And obviously social boundaries for that matter as well, right?
Yeah, I mean, we have one planet, so that's obvious. And there's various studies over the years which have shown that as a species, humans take out of the planet, you know, far more resources than we can possibly take to sustain that planet. And it's a multiple, really. If we think of the extraction of timber and conversion of forest lands to agriculture or extraction of seafood from the oceans, we do this far greater extent than we should really, because of ecological boundaries wouldn't allow us to sustain the planet. So yeah, we're in a decade of challenges and we're in a century of consequences.
And I want to come back to that, because I want to put it in question into, okay, the initiatives you've been working on. But if I try to understand kind of this development of, you know, Mark going from these 25 years working on financial industries and how you were working on this in a way, you know, it could be seen as some of the first funds, right? That were sustainable funds, as we call them now. We may talk about ESG when we come to measurement as well. And now, you know, driving, you know, creating the thesis and driving all these different initiatives you're working on. How did it all work? You know, what ignited that passion, that drive to understand and to take action this way?
Yeah, gosh, that's the question that doesn't have a straightforward or an easy answer, but I'll give it a go. So I'm from the family of Italian immigrants. My father's Italian, my mother is English. I was born in England, but my father and my grandfather, they started life in Puglia in southern Italy, looking after olive trees and almond trees. And they came from the soil. They came from nature, really. And if you could inherit anything in your genes, I inherited a keen interest in the world around me and the natural environment. And probably, you know, my grandfather and his father and his fathers before him were looking after these centuries old olive trees in our family fields, as they then were. So I maybe inherited something of that. But then, because he was a sharecropper, he used to work on other people's land as well to make a living. And life in Italy between the wars and after the war was very tough, as anybody who knows about it will testify. My grandfather was also a radical. He was, in his case, him and the other workers formed together and became founders of what was then the Communist Party in southern Italy between the wars. And they had this radical, you know, working, building a collective of other workers to challenge landowners and property owners that were taking advantage of them. And I kind of admire that, really. So anyway, when my father arrived in England and I was born, we were not born into a university-going family. We weren't born into people. Well, my father left school at the age of 11, like a lot of people did, and started work at that age and that time. And so I didn't grow up in a house full of books. That was a bit missing. So we had to learn a lot ourselves from that schooling life. But we did learn values and identity with others around, including, you know, being brought up in not a Catholic family, but a values-based family driven by a belief. And I think that was an important thing. So anyway, when I was 15, I started to work with a local aid and a charity that was focused on the third world, or what was called the third world, the developing world. And that charity is called Tear Fund, close to where I lived. And that got me as a volunteer, and I got an interest in overseas development. And then I met this guy down the pub, and he said, "Which university are you going to?" And I hadn't really thought about it. I didn't really know that many people that went to university. And so I said, "Well, where do you go?" And he said, "Well, I go to a place called York University." And he said, "Why don't you go there?" So I went there, did politics and economic history, including the politics of rural development. And that connected me back to some of my roots. And then after that, I crossed the Sahara Desert with some friends from university. And when I was coming back, this was when the famine challenges of both East Africa and West Africa was coming through. This was 1985, 86, from the year of Band-Aid, Live Aid. And I got back, and some friends had created a company that was advising Band-Aid, Live Aid on project selection, and I became an analyst for that team. And I got to know about that. And then I did my master's in agricultural economics. And I wrote my thesis on environmental cost accounting techniques as part of a soil and water conservation project in Shoa in Ethiopia. This would have been about 87, 88. And then with that, that allowed me to go and work in Tanzania and in Kenya on projects, including a fair trade project in Moshi in Tanzania, the first kind of incubated fair trade coffee at the Kilimanjaro Native Cooperative Union with the Schluter family. And from that, I came back, I got unwell, came back, and I thought a lot of my ideas started to change, thinking, oh, we need trade and we need fair trade, but we also need societies, people to have their own sustainable livelihoods, and they need capital. And what the West has, the North has, is capital. And so the challenge we're going to face is, how do we bring capital from the North, from the pension funds and the banks, to the South, to help create sustainable development? And that really informed my thinking in the late 80s, early 90s, and through the WBCSD work on changing course and financing changing course. But the real change was in late 1988. I met an amazing woman called Tessa Tennant, who founded the Ecology Fund, which is now at Jupiter. And I joined her and Jupiter in beginning of 1989. And it moved, and I became at Jupiter, one of the founders of those funds business with three others. And that started my life in green finance. And in many ways, I kind of landed on my feet, because the things I've been thinking about, how can we change markets and capitalism? And there's the old saying about, how do you change capitalism? And the answer is, first thing you need to do is take control of the capital. And in a kind of a trite way, that's what we were doing. We were creating funds, taking control of the capital, which had come from the public and from church groups and local authority pension funds. And we were investing in business that we thought were part of the sustainable world. That was really what the mission was at, first it was a little company called Merlin, and then at Jupiter. And then the team, as we grew, we started involved in policy issues. I mentioned the Earth Summit in 1992 and the WBCSD. And it was really about, how can we change financial markets for good? And that's really what my journey was from the 1990s onwards, in building the sustainable investment funds. And I get terribly confused by people talking about ESG and stuff like that, and sustainability screens and stuff like that. What we were doing then was investing in very often very small companies doing recycling. And I remember clearly looking at organic food business. We invested in geothermal energy. And in America, we'd invested in the first off-grid renewable energy business called New World Power. And so for me, it was what the businesses did, and that got my later interest in impact investing. It was clearly about what companies do. And in 1993, I remember going to meet some people doing early stage recycling, separating waste, the cans and paper. And it was called Waste Recycling Group, and they floated on the stock exchange with a value of 10 million. This would have been the early 1990s, and it went on to become, via Terra Firma, Guy Hans bought it 10 years later for £1 billion. I mean, we didn't continue our share of the scale of the size of the investment, but it was one of the first investments I made. And that got me going into the world of green finance. So that's a bit of the early journey. And then Carbon Tracker and other issues to do with forestry and ecosystems came a little bit later through the 90s, but we can talk about that. But that's really how my story evolved. And I'm a great believer that if you stick to what interests you, what you're drawn to naturally, so yeah, to an extent, your beliefs and how you interpret the world and relate to others around you, that can help launch you into what would become, for me, a career. But I was probably one of the first three or four what you call green analysts in the City of London, or ESG analysts. We pretty much all knew each other then, and we'd created the first trade body, UCSIF, the UK, what was used to be called the UK Social Investment Forum, is now called the UK Sustainable and Responsible Investment Forum. And kind of knew each other. We were kind of a community, and now we're a much bigger community. Here we are in 2020, 30 years on.
Fascinating. Yeah, it's interesting to hear. Thank you very much for sharing kind of that part of the story, because the values-based point, you know, I think you mentioned, you know, maybe the Catholic or Christian, maybe relation coming from Italy as well. And then a bit of some of the situations, you know, sometimes, you know, there's a bit of that lag that some people talk about, you know, when you met that person that then you ended up going to York. But it seems to be that, you know, right from the beginning, you were quite lucky to kind of have a passion and understanding of, you know, what was driving you, right?
But you also have to create your own luck, and you also have to recognize when you're being given a break as well, and to grasp it with both hands. I mean, I didn't have such a thing as called a career path. There were no careers in green finance in London in 1988, 1989. I was very fortunate to, you know, not knowing anybody in the world of finance. To me, going into finance meant becoming a clerk at the local bank. I had no idea about this investment world. But I didn't know about the Stop the City protests from the mid-80s. If anybody remembers the Stop the City protests, I went on a couple of those. I knew what I didn't like by a fairly early age. And meeting Tessa was when she sort of said, well, actually, there's this green path, and this is what we're going to do together. And the other thing, you know, in those early years, a lot of the people with the original ideas were women. And some of them that I got to know then have gone on to do astonishing things. And apart from Tessa, there's another one who had a big impact. So there's a woman called Anne Simpson, who's now at CalPERS. And she's the founding chair of the Climate Action 100, which is this $46 trillion coalition of investors. There she was in, you know, 1989, 1990, 1991, publishing guides to greening finance and launching shareholder activism campaigns. And Simpson, you know, she's had a remarkable impact on the world around us. And, you know, there are plenty of others that were fund managers or analysts with a similar story.
Fascinating. And we'll come back as well on that point, I think, when we talk about some of the activities happening. It's interesting. I thought that there was maybe a big shift, but it was an evolution, right? Because there was a shift at one point where, you know, worked for 25 years on the industry, and then we were having a different call on another day. You were mentioning that many people that you know went to found quite a few of the well-known firms now on sustainable investing, right? That went with you, Henderson, but then you went and tagged to, you know, taking action by, you know, having a Carbon Tracker and these other initiatives. What made you change the direction in a certain way?
I first encountered the problem of global warming or climate change when I was at university in 1983-84. I was writing an article for a student magazine called The Green Insurgent. And in that magazine was an article about burning fossil fuels will contribute to climate change. And it kind of stuck in my mind and thought, well, that's interesting. That's something to think about. And in the 1990s, I had conversations with a few friends who said, well, look, this is all a forward-looking issue. It's not emissions from the past that we can do anything about. It's the emissions coming down the line in the future. It's the development of the fossil fuels by the fossil fuel industry. And this was a conversation I had with people like Andy Roll, who writes for Oil Change International, and Oliver Tikal also, who wrote on this subject. But then the first chairman of Carbon Tracker, which was Jeremy Leggett, who was then at Greenpeace, and we all had these similar conversations linking it back to finance and the world of finance. And I noticed through the 1990s and the early noughties how London had really become one of the key financial centres for banking and financing and insuring the fossil fuel industry. And there were two deals that sort of really caught my eye or really rather stuck in my throat. The first was a company called Asia Energy, which was a coal business, a coal mine, trying to build the largest coal-fired power station in Bangladesh, and it listed on the London Stock Exchange. And in the documentation associated with it, they were describing how whilst Bangladesh was increasingly underwater, not to worry, the coal mine and the coal plant was in an area beyond the reach of flooding. And as we know, Bangladesh is one of the first countries to be hit by extreme weather events, including rising sea levels and floods. And the other was a coal company that tried to list in Australia and then came to list in London. It was called Extraton, is now part of Glencore. And the prospectus, which ran to 300 pages, only mentioned climate change really in passing in around 20 lines, and they kind of dismissed it as a business risk. And I chatted with my colleague Nick Robbins, who's the other founder of Carbon Tracker, about this, and we felt that, you know, if it was true of this company, it's probably going to be true of all the others raising money. And we just asked ourselves, well, I wonder how many companies are raising money, and I wonder whether Shell and Exxon can achieve their business plans. And if we look forwards, which is the reserves and the resources that they plan to develop, how much carbon dioxide is going to be released by all these companies raising money in London and in New York? And that really led to the idea of what became Carbon Tracker, trying to find an answer to that. And between about 2003 and 2007, 2008, Nick and I presented our ideas to various conferences and events, and we went around to see our friends at Greenpeace and Friends of the Earth and Christian Aid. And in 2007, Nick and I published an article on something called the Quality of Life Challenge website, which was a conservative party, even though that's not the party I belong to. They were interested in the ideas. A guy called Nick Hurd and Zach Goldsmith and a few of the others there were wanted to get this article, this idea published. And then we published it. And then in 2009, we created the entity to do the research, but it took us 2 years to raise the money. So it took 10 years from having the idea to raising the money that allowed us to do the research. And a guy, Jamie Arbib, through his foundation, the Telus Marta Foundation, gave us the initial few thousand pounds to test the idea. And the idea was looking at the world's top 200 coal, oil and gas companies, what would happen if they were to produce all their reserves. And the researcher came back and said, yeah, you've got something, Mark, but I've gone and got myself a new job. Here's your report. And it was enough for Jeremy Leggett to write an article in The Guardian that was read by members of the Rockefeller family in America and their advisors. And they contacted Jeremy, and Jeremy sort of said, well, there's this guy called Nick and Mark, and they're researching this. And we received a grant from the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, who then went on, as you know, to divest fossil fuels. And that allowed us to bring in a great guy called James Leeton. And James, Nick and me held the pen for what became The Unburnable Carbon, Are the Financial Markets Carrying a Carbon Bubble report in 2011 that first launched the carbon bubble idea. And we put that to bed. We produced a report, didn't really think too much about it. And we had a very good article in the Financial Times from Lord Stern, Nick Stern, about the carbon tracker research. And there was just, you know, three of us at the time doing this. But the real change happened when Bill McKibben from Rolling Stone wrote an article in Rolling Stone magazine. Bill McKibben, the American campaigner and academic and writer on climate change, and he wrote this Global Warming's Terrifying New Math. Still worth reading it off Rolling Stone's website. He wrote this in, it would have been about July 2012, which he summarized our numbers, and he launched the divestment movement off the back of that. And that really changed things quite dramatically. We had our report that was going out, and people like HSBC were writing about our analysis, but really it was the divestment movement taking off that catalyzed a global movement looking at what we then called stranded assets.
Yes.
And a following up report with Lord Stern in 2013 called Wasted Capital and Stranded Assets, where we really coined the phrase stranded assets in association with burnable carbon. And this thing really exploded. And we managed to go from having three members of staff, I think we went as far as having four people by then. So this is a very small organization at that time. But it really took off, and I've been thrilled, and I think Nick has been thrilled, and the others, to see how the organization has evolved. And I now have 30 colleagues at Carbon Tracker in America and in London and Australia as analysts writing about the future of the fossil fuel industry and stranded assets.
Fascinating. Thank you so much for sharing that, because it's so much in such a short period of time that you share that. So going the fact that it takes so long to develop an idea, which effectively the way I look at it now, your whole evolution to this 2003 point, all those kind of, what is it, like 6 years or so, I think you mentioned 10 in total until you managed to get some funding, you know, the sequence of events of the different articles. And I was going to ask you about the funding. How did you manage to fund all this? So you actually answered the question before.
Yeah, and it was, you know, the Grellwald Family Fund and the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, and then Joe, particularly in the UK, Joseph Rowntree, and a small little foundation called Poldham Puckham. And then the inspiration really of a few of the funders, particularly Ellen Dorsey at Wallace Global Fund and Tom Cruise and Joanna Messing and a few others, and another foundation called Marva Foundation, a guy called Holger. And together they're incredibly supportive. And the thing about ideas, because it was a kind of an idea that took a time to gestate. The thing about,
yes,
there's an old Chinese saying that ideas are a curse until you can get rid of them. And I think I felt cursed, and maybe Nick felt the same through the late 90s, early noughties, as the ideas evolved, that we wanted to turn it into something. But of course, we had full-time jobs. And it was only really when that funding came through from the Rockefellers and James Leeton popped up that we are able to tie all the different loose parts down and published this thesis, which is now, I think, commonly accepted. And I was looking today at Bloomberg's news service, and one of the news headlines is on stranded assets in the fossil fuel industry. And I've been tweeting Bloomberg today, and the article's called Stranded Assets Risk Rising with Climate Action and $40 a Barrel Oil. You know, people are still talking about it sort of 9 years, nearly 10 years on, and it's still something which remains very topical because it's an issue which is about the future of the planet. It's an issue which has huge financial relevance, and it's very much also tied to financial stability, about the security of the banking system, the security of people's pension schemes. It's about the kind of world we want, and it's also about the kind of finance and financial system that we want. And it's really the chance to express that idea was to help people rethink really the purpose of, yes, finance. And the purpose of markets, and how we introduce the idea of ecological boundaries into how we analyze risk and the markets.
Yes, and I was going to mention that. Before I say that, I was going to say again, big thank you to all the foundations and all the people that, you know, supported you so that you could get to where you are now. And on that point that you were mentioning, so basically you are challenging this conventional thinking, you know, this perceived risk versus the real risk, so that we can then see the monetary and the financial implication of it, you know, and look at how do we manage this energy transition, how we can intervene, right? And that's basically what your, I call it, you know, companies, by your organization, let's say we start with Carbon Tracker, that is what it set itself to do, right? To be able to help people learn more about it, think about it, and then take action on the back of it. So that's the purpose.
So we have a goal, which is a financial system and energy markets which are aligned with the goals of the Paris Climate Agreement of well below 2 degrees. So in that, we have different teams, an oil and gas team and a power and utility team and a regulatory and disclosure team and a new energy transition team whose jobs are to work with investors and educate and inform pension fund trustees. On Friday, I'm presenting to one of the largest pension schemes trustee board, one of the largest pension schemes in the UK, to their trustees and their investment consultants. So I get a good 45 minutes or an hour talking through climate risk. And we work with, you know, financial analysts and modelers and so on around the world. And that's really our philanthropic purpose. And what we're trying to do is avoid, we think regulators will act in time, inevitably, and the policy will come in. And what we're trying to do is avoid a catastrophic transition, but rather have one which is orderly and secure for people's livelihoods. Because if we leave it too late, climate disaster or rapid action by government could be disorderly and disruptive. And, you know, that's not good for the planet. It's not good for people's pensions or for markets. So that's really our goal, is to allow for a safe landing and whilst avoiding runaway climate change.
Yes, because it's much, much harder, you know, to catch up after the disasters, right? And the investment requirements. So, and very, very good that you're talking to the trustees, because if I had one comment that I have, you know, heard and picked up from other people, other guests and different experts in the industry I talk to, is sometimes that the trustees are slightly separated, you know, in different levels, you know, to understanding all of these. So on that perspective, you know, so you have different organizations that are using your reports and the work that you're doing. So you're creating awareness and you are educating. So in terms of, let's say, you're the users or the, you know, clients that you have, and now you have the trustees of the pensions, I understand that you had quite an influence on even on the Bank of England and some of the actions they have, you know, taken in terms of Mr. Carney and the DCFD as well, if that's correct. So you presented to them at one point, right?
Yeah, so the first report on burnable carbon was really, it was, even though it was picked up by the divestment movement, it was actually written as a long letter to financial regulators, to accountants and audit firms, and to people responsible for stock exchange listing rules and for credit rating agencies and so on. And we went in, this is Jeremy Leggett and our second chairman, Saka Nelsonby, who's now at Federated Hermes. We went in to see the Bank of England. We went in a few times to continue our exchanges, really, that had started when, around the time of, this is with also with the financial, what was then the Financial Services Authority, at the time when Xstrata listed in the London market. And we continued exchanges. And in 2015, Mark Carney and the Bank of England asked me to present the research to something called the Financial Stability Board of the G20, which is all the different heads of the different central banks. And so I went into a very large, very sort of awesome room in London full of bankers sitting around a large table, or rather around a large square, and presented this analysis and answered a few questions. And then Mark Carney himself went on to give his speech at Lloyd's, where he picked up the phrases of that we'd used on our research, unburnable carbon and stranded assets and financial stability. And he gave his amazing financial stability speech, which again, in the same way that Bill McKibben with the divestment movement managed to change everything, Mark Carney, carrying this message into the world of financial markets regulation, has changed everything. And I was able and asked to present to the first meetings of something called the TCFD, the Task Force on Climate-Related Financial Disclosure, to begin to talk through about the types of disclosures we thought that companies should be making as they respond to dealing with the climate crisis and the climate challenge for their own businesses. So it was that regulatory intervention that I thought was key. And there's even more work to come down the line, particularly in my view with the accounting profession and what we're going to have to do with writing down what Carbon Tracker estimates to be the $30 trillion of fixed assets in the fossil fuel economy that we're going to have to lose over the next decade or so as we transform into a low carbon world. And this will have, again, huge consequences for markets. So regulators, yeah, a crucial part of the jigsaw puzzle. And in our what we call our theory of change, we have two core communities, the investors, decision makers, and then financial regulators working together. And you'll notice together that both those, I don't talk about government really, I think others do work with policy much better than Carbon Tracker does. Ours is really around the idea that markets can move often quicker than government.
Yes.
And the financial regulators, their rules, like accounting standards, apply transnationally across borders in a way that other laws often don't. And there's a world of parallel regulations and laws, which are called financial markets regulations, which exist alongside state laws and systems. And it's amazing how quickly there's consolidation of views across borders on accounting standards and so on internationally, which can be used to the benefit of, as we see it in Carbon Tracker, dealing with the climate crisis.
Yes. And also, I think you mentioned here, you know, the regulation, the accounting, you know, all a bit of what supports all of the financial services. But if I picked up from another conversation that I heard you speaking, you do believe that private sector has kind of the biggest role. It's not just regulations and governments and accounting, but the private sector that is going to be the one that can make the difference. And together with that, you mentioned about, I think, the financial kind of sector in terms of the investors, right? So investors potentially will move much faster, a bit like a climate disaster, just best much quicker than what companies can adjust in terms of their transition, right? So they'll be without funding.
Yeah, I think that investors, particularly where investors are their own fiduciaries, i.e. they're taking their decisions themselves rather than on behalf of other people, they can act in their interests and they can choose if their interests are aligned with society's interests or the planet's interests. And that's why the movement of certain pension funds and certain insurance companies and foundations have really been quite decisive. And they don't have to be wait to be told by governments to act. They're free actors and they can choose to act, and they can act collectively and do things to benefit society in ways which governments can often be too slow to act. I certainly think the arrival of financial actors at the Paris Climate Summit, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, was profound in terms of the benefit that it brought, because what it did really is it acted as a counterweight to the business lobby that was trying to say to governments, oh, you know, this is bad for employment, bad for business, bad for our shareholders. And when the shareholders turned up and gave a contrary message saying, no, actually, it's good for the business, it's good for us as investors, then it created a little bit of political space to allow policymakers to actually push back and say, look, if your shareholders say this is fine and the science says it's fine and our voters says it's fine, then we've listened to what you've said, business, but actually now's the time to act. And I think that's one of the things, messages that came out of the Paris Climate Agreement, was that investors were absolutely aligned with a safe outcome. You know, as it's been said before, and I've said it as well, is there's no pension. What's the point of a pension and retirement if there's no planet worth retiring into? And I think that's so true. And pension fund trustees know this, and their job is to also to ensure that their beneficiaries actually have a world worth retiring into. And young people know this, and trustees of pension funds know this, and it's a profoundly logical argument.
Yeah, yeah. Now, if we talk about identifying and measuring impact, which is one of the sections we talk about in the podcast with guests, and you know, you have the carbon tracker and burnable carbon thesis, then you launch Fish Tracker, now you have Planet Tracker. So, and obviously, so I was going to ask you, how did that develop and how is that measuring the impact? You know, are you measuring impact in terms of the people that are taking actions, or do you have a methodology, or how do we look at this?
Yeah, so the arguments or the analysis around ecological boundaries aren't just limited to the atmosphere, they also apply to land and to the oceans. And I've begun to think about how we could translate these ideas to other sectors. Really, probably even before carbon tracking, with forests. And I've been very interested in looking at stock exchange listed forestry companies that were logging rainforests in Asia. And I thought, well, actually, you know, markets, fund investors have a role there too. But it was really bumping up against a Chinese seafood company listed on the London Stock Exchange. Really got me back to thinking that whilst we complain about what others do on the other side of the world, often what they do is because they've been funded through London. And I thought, well, actually, if there's a Chinese fishing company in London, how many seafood companies are there listed on exchanges around the world? And Marva Foundation and Oak Foundation, who had backed Carbon Tracker, decided to back Fish Tracker and also Fred Mulder's foundation as well. And that allowed us to do a piece of research which we called Empty Nets. Empty Nets because the banks were financing more and more boats to go fishing without actually doing any analysis of whether there was any fish to be caught. It's rather bizarre, you know, building, they have this kind of view, build more boats, you'll catch more fish, and the more fish you catch, the more money you'll make, which is true until you reach the point when there's far too many boats chasing too few fish, in which case, you know, there's going to be more stranded assets in the case of fishing boats. And what we discovered, much to our surprise, is that in fact, there's over 200 stock exchange listed seafood and aquatics companies. And the biggest of them are, well, together they turn over $80 billion. And this, just this group of 200 are worth some $500 billion. And we estimated that once you took into account the fish caught by these companies or fish processed through stock exchange listed food processing and canning companies, that something like a half of the world's seafood was going through the world's stock markets. And there you've got that link between natural capital and financial markets. And what we see in nature is a reflection of what we see in markets. And then some of the other funders said, well, if you can do it with seafood, can you really think about doing it beyond seafood? What about, and so, well, now that became Planet Tracker, and now we're looking at water and plastics and textiles, and we're very fortunate. Nick and I founded Planet Tracker. We had a very supportive board with John and Alison Carey, and we found Robin Millington, who we knew from the world of climate, and Robin came in to lead Planet Tracker, and that now has 17 staff. And some great hires from the world of finance, including some very sort of senior research analysts that have come in from places like JP Morgan and Deutsche Bank to work at Planet Tracker. And we're turning out research on seafood and agriculture, and it's very exciting.
Yeah, because interesting. At one point I was going to ask you, you know, if it was fish, why not meat? You know, given that some documentaries complain that meat is actually contaminating or producing more CO2 than all of the rest things that are producing problems, right? Such as coal and fossil fuels. But I don't know what's your view on that.
That's true. That's true. So we're looking at the whole of the agricultural sector, including meat. Mm-hmm.
And yes, and yeah, that goes hand in hand, right? Because that's one thing that I didn't appreciate, how much of the production of the deforestation and the production of agriculture is just basically to feed the animals, which is part of their own supply chain. Interesting. Okay, that is fascinating. And in terms of I can see now, so the impact that it's been having, although perhaps all the actions that you've taken, all the reports, so you can see how it's been pushing people into taking action and creating movements and Climate Action 100 and, the Bank of England. And I think some specific, like you mentioned, some pension trustees and some specific companies, insurance companies and investment companies as well have taken action on the back of that. So that would be your direct contribution and impact that you are having, through the activities, right? And then I was going to ask you, because I'm assuming that all of this is very good in terms of taking the information and then becoming aware and then trying to do something about your strategies, your investment strategies, right? But people tend to use or understand more about the use of, let's say, ESG information and ESG ratings. So how have you seen the use of one or the other people actually using to try to manage their risk and their investment strategies?
Yeah, so what we've seen happen was a couple of different things happen. A lot of investors have said, okay, we're really entering the end of the fossil fuel age, and it's the speed of the clean energy transition is disrupting the business models of the incumbents like Exxon and BP and so on, and will divest. And so a whole number of divested, and that's reached the assets divested now of fossil fuels have reached around $14 trillion globally. Others have said, well, actually, this is really about risk to existing business models. We can maybe persuade companies to move faster and engage with them. And that's the sort of the engagement movement. And that's reflected through the work of Climate Action 100 with its $46 trillion coalition. And Carbon Tracker provides the data and analytics on power and utilities and oil and gas to investment managers. Then there's a sort of a third area, and it's what I call fundamental analysis, which is where you think, okay, as part of our risk analysis, maybe markets are mispricing the risk, and let's change our valuation models to, for example, by using more aggressive discount rates or higher costs of capital, and maybe a sensitivity analysis that writes down the value of fossil fuel reserves or fixed assets like pipelines and oil rigs, maybe do that more aggressively. And once you've done that, it's a kind of a stress test, really, on your valuation. You then see what these companies are worth. And I think growing numbers of investors are doing this, and you would have thought that the world of finance would have got onto this already. There's still a lot of the market looks at companies based on the business as usual assumption without these kinds of remodeling or stress tests. And so that third area is something that particularly interests me. And Carbon Tracker in the last sort of year or two, a couple of years now, have worked with four or five hedge funds, which have begun to short the fossil fuel industry and go long the clean economy. People like Worm Capital and Fossil Free Indices and Height, a few others, like Kapos Capital. And that's really the market reacting to mispricing of risk. And I think we're going to see a lot more of that in the future.
Okay. And you mentioned the word engagement, which quite a few of the active investors stress that is the way that they can make a difference. And then on the other side, going short and then long on the green economy, which is, by influencing through the capital. Kind of, I was just going to ask, how much engagement is enough, before you call it a day and move the capital to solutions? Or if you had to put a weight, this combination of balance weighting to all of the different actions that we're taking, or this one that will have more power or more impact influence?
Yeah. So anybody that had sold out of the fossil fuel sector or shorted it, from 10 years ago, has done exceptionally well, both on a relative basis and an absolute basis. The valuations have really collapsed. And so people had divested, whether for moral reasons or for financial reasons, it has been a good call. Okay. But if your goal is dealing with climate change, we need to bring the whole sector rapidly to a close. And I have been supporting something called the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty, which is a plan for a global agreement to give up the development of fossil fuels. So there's a website called fossilfueltreaty.org. And that really, to me, is about the end game, which is about giving up licenses, cancelling back licenses for coal, oil and gas for projects that take us above 1.5 degrees. And so I think we need a more forceful intervention. So what should investors be doing? Well, one of the forms of forceful intervention, I believe, is a shareholder battle that doesn't just try to get companies to produce a Paris-aligned business plan, but actually says, look, if you're not going to do this, we're going to come up with a new board and we're going to find new board directors and ultimately new management teams. And that I imagine we're going to move into a form of investor activism in the years ahead, shortly, that will be much more demanding, that says, look, if you're not going to change your plan, your strategy, we're going to change it for you by removing you from your board positions. Now, that form of investor activism, done individually or done as a group around alternative business plans, to me is very compelling.
Yes, I mean, some of the, you know, points that kind of organizations like Share Action are pushing forward, right? And I was going to double check with you how much of an influence you think that kind of litigation funds will have in all of these as well. Because we talked about that separately, but I know
I think litigation is one tactic. I'm interested, fascinated by a new litigation fund, a social environmental litigation fund called Aristata, set up by some people who worked in litigation at PwC, company litigation, and somebody was working at Klein Earth. And I thought, well, this is a terrific idea, actually. And to sue companies for damages, which are then shared with communities that have been impacted by what these companies have been doing. So it has its place. It's not the only tacit strategy. Mm-hmm. And if companies won't voluntarily compensate or voluntarily change, then litigation as an avenue. And I should imagine that the court actions we've been seeing in America around climate justice filed against fossil fuel companies will only grow in number.
And then to kind of close the kind of the battle about the future section, I wanted to check with you in terms of, we talked about so many different things, I guess, that we can do to try to help transition more capital into sustainable and impact investing, you know, applying all of these different techniques and areas and efforts. And I did pick up one article that you share on the Leonardo DiCaprio Foundation, which coincidentally I also saw that Al Gore and Gavin McCormick, CEO of World Time, posted on July this year, announcing the launch of this new coalition called Climate Trace, which is about using AI to track real-time atmospheric carbon emissions. So is that something you can share with us in terms of what else can we do towards the future to push, you know, the transition and the movement of capital?
Yeah, so transparency around emissions, where are the emissions coming from, which companies, which sectors is crucial. And the partnership with Trace, the partnership with What Time and other groups, with satellites, with the support of Google.Earth, is really about that matter of transparency, opening up to markets, to shareholders, to society, to citizens, to local communities impacted by what these companies are doing, what the emissions profiles are from coal-fired power stations or from methane leakage. And transparency is an absolutely crucial element of accountability. Without transparency, it's impossible to enforce accountability. And a lot of what Carbon Tracker does is about that. For us, we do financial modeling of coal-fired power stations and gas-fired power stations to look at their viability in the context of the energy transition. And so all this kind of analysis and data is going to help. And we've got some terrific partners supporting that work.
Fantastic. I will share more information on the podcast notes if people want to learn more about it. And as we're coming to towards the end, I wanted to ask you, you have met so many people, so many leaders, you know, that are doing so many good things, you know, in the world. And you mentioned that right at the beginning about, you know, the importance of values. So what values or what characteristics do you think make a leader, or more specifically, an impact leader? Yeah, have you noticed in these individuals? You know,
that for makes me, difference? Yeah. The leaders which impress me are ones that are able to understand and interpret the world around them and articulate a message that goes far beyond their immediate circle. and to communicate ideas that reach far. And that's why I liked what, you know, my old friend Tessa Tennant, who's sadly no longer with us, but she used to be able to extend that reach. And Bill McKibben does that, and Ellen Dorsey does that in Wallace Global Fund. And my friends who are building this fossil fuel non-proliferation treaty, Zipporah Berman and others, have this leadership quality that allows you to extend far and wide with great passion and courage, actually, because sometimes the things that you say are uncomfortable. So in some ways, you know, these analogies to the Old Testament prophets of bygone age, where people are trying to alert the world around them to an urgent injustice or an urgent challenge. And I've been naturally drawn to people with the insights and the imagination, and also people that have managed to attract the attention of a wider audience and have done it through a corporate platform. So people like Natasha Landell-Mills at Bank Saracen with their work on accounting, and Miriam Omi at Legal & General on climate accountability, and Steve Waygood at Aviva Investors on his whole work on sustainability. These are people that, you know, to me are tremendously impressive. Obviously, these are sort of UK, British examples and people that I've got to know. So, yeah, so they all have a common characteristic of great insight, great study, amazing communication ability, and to reach beyond their immediate circle to a much bigger audience with a powerful influence and a powerful narrative.
Yes, I was thinking exactly about that. It's the kind of amazing communication ability, right, to be able to get that message across.
It also helps to be honest, and to be selfless, I think. And these are people that are not saying the things that they're saying because of personal reward or anything else like that, but are saying it because they're alerting the world. I mean, I'm also particularly interested in the world of private equity and venture capital and fee structures and things like where companies are domiciled for tax. And there's still battles to be fought in the world of finance. We're not solving everything. And it's incredible how the compensation structures and the tax structures of people working in the field of ESG reflect old style values, not modern values. The work of people like Delilah Rothenberg at the Pre-Distribution Initiative, for example, in America, where she's looking at this, the relationship between, you know, finance and society and compensation incentives, and who really benefits from the world of finance. So these are all questions for the next 10 years that need to be resolved.
Okay. And one final call to action for our listeners, maybe on the back of all of those comments, alerting the world.
It's been set off, and the money can be used as a force for good or a force for bad. And too often, I think people talk about the bad things that money does. And, you know, carbon tracking is really calling out some of that bad aspects. But the thing I've learned, well, I knew this anyway, is that you can't stop a group of 10 people getting together to revolutionize and change things. And we've seen that in how the financial communities come together through initiatives like Climate Action 100 to really pick up the challenge and to use their influence as a force for good. But the challenges that we face aren't going away, and they're multifaceted, whether it's through tax structures and so on, or that we see, or whether it's fair pay or in a living wage, or whether it's through loss of biodiversity, through markets exploiting the less developed parts of the world for their own gain. These are all challenges, and for the next century, and as people have come through to do today's challenges like climate change, they'll come through to fight those challenges. And I know that in that respect, I won't be able to retire. And I've enjoyed what I've been doing the last 30 years. I hope I have another 30 to continue what I've been involved in starting. Thank you.
Fantastic. And how can people get in touch with you?
Yeah, if people want to contact me, you can follow me or message me on my Twitter handle, which is @CampanileMark. So my surname and my first name, @CampanileMark. Or they can subscribe to Carbon Tracker's newsletters via our website, carbontracker.org. And I can also be found on LinkedIn.
Fantastic. Thank you so, so much for your time.
Lovely. Really appreciate it.
I appreciate it even more. Thank you so much. It is bye for now. And until our next episode of Impact Leaders, and God bless you all, please remember to check our sponsors' website for upcoming events. Bye.
Thank you for listening to Impact Leaders. Impact Leaders is brought to you by ILEAN Partners and Fast Forward 2030. Please connect with us at ILEAN Partners for advice on how to transition into sustainable and impact investing. And go to fastforward2030.com to learn how to include the global goals into your business models.